I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 8 men are in custody after the suicide bombing attack at the Manchester Arena in Manchester, England on Monday night that killed 22 people, many of them young women and teenage girls who were fans of the pop singer Ariana Grande. Many more were injured, some still in critical condition. The bomber, identified as Salman Abedi, was a British citizen, the child of immigrants from Libya, and is thought to be part of a network. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. Britain has raised the terror threat to critical, its highest level, and the country observed a moment of silence today. Rukmini Kalamachi covers ISIS and al-Qaeda for the New York Times, and we asked her to join us on Radio Times. And nice to have you back on the show.
Good morning.
You follow ISIS chatter, if I can put it that way, online. Did they pick this target because it was a young female pop star and her young, largely female fans?
I don't think so. The messaging that they've put out is that the target was chosen because, as they said, it was a profligate concert. So it was in their ideology, a place of sin. This is a place where women are uncovered, where women and men are mingling, where they're listening to music, all sorts of things that they consider un-Islamic.
They have claimed responsibility, and I know you have sort of followed that, so determining, you know, what is the official claim from ISIS and what is an unofficial claim. Help us how you determine that.
So the Islamic State by now has established a protocol for which they claim attacks. They've been claiming them since 2014, so they've had several years to finesse this process. And the way that they do so now is through a messaging app called Telegram, which people can download on their phones from the App Store. On Telegram, they have secret chat rooms in which they and their members congregate. These chat rooms are being deleted and suspended every day. So every day they're putting up new ones. But if you follow them, you know that that certain chat rooms are official ISIS chat rooms. They include Nashir and they include Amok. Typically, they claim attacks first on Amok. Mm-hmm. This time, they claimed it first on Nashir. That's not the first time that's happened, but it is less usual than what they typically do, which is to claim it on the other channel. They claimed it about 14 and a half hours after the attack. They put out a bulletin first in Arabic and later translated into Russian, English, and a number of other languages. And it said very succinctly that this was in retaliation for transgressions against the homes of Muslims. That's a sentence that I took to mean that they're retaliating against the airstrikes in Mosul. And then they went on to say that a soldier of the caliphate had placed explosive devices, plural, amidst the concert goers.
So does that tell us that Salman Abedi was a member of ISIS?
It tells us that they consider him a member of their terror group. And so far, everything that we've seen seems to point that way.
Does ISIS ever claim responsibility for attacks that they did not do? Do they ever lie about it, I guess, is another way to ask that?
I think that's the assumption that that's the perception that most people have. And the reality is, I've been tracking ISIS attacks since 2014. And they are remarkably disciplined in only claiming attacks that they have done or that they have inspired. And that's the thing that you have to understand. They consider inspired attacks to be very much their handiwork. There are a few counterexamples, but they're very few. And the vast majority are attacks that fall into one of these two categories.
President Trump this week called them losers, something he had called his political opponents when he was on the campaign trail. You have written that ISIS has called Trump an idiot who doesn't know what Syria or Iraq or Islam is. So we've got ISIS and the President of the United States calling each other names. What does that tell us?
My goodness, I don't know that I have any commenting, Carrie, on that beyond what you have elucidated.
But does that let me take what Trump called ISIS losers? Mm-hmm. Does that hurt their feelings? I don't know how else to ask that.
I really don't think so. I mean, I think that they are so far beyond name calling. This is a group that has basically pledged to try to annihilate Western civilization. So we're at a point beyond loser and idiot.
What I mean is that what they want, to annihilate Western civilization? Do they want their own caliphate? What,
yes.
As you understand
yes.
it, what I does mean, ISIS want?
I mean, they've been very clear about what their goals are. They want to establish an Islamic caliphate that stretches across the world. We've seen them put out maps that show the flag of ISIS flying from every continent. I remember that it included even from Iceland. So every country and every continent. And they have very forcefully said that they want everyone to convert to their narrow version of Islam.
Of course, that's never going to happen. Does that mean that terror attacks will continue?
You know, this is the difficult thing about this ideology. Ever since it really burst onto the world stage with Osama bin Laden, it doesn't seem like we have figured out what to do to tame it or even to make it decrease. There are more jihadists now than there ever were in the early years of Al Qaeda. The airstrikes don't seem to be helping, and we haven't figured out a credible way to try to de-radicalize people. So this remains, in my opinion, a major issue and a major problem that we as a society are facing.
How do you think people can be de-radicalized?
I don't think we know. One thing I've noticed is the people I have spoken to who have managed to pull themselves out of the equation themselves, and there are very few, but there are some. I'm referring to, for example, Mubin Sheikh, who was flirting with the Taliban decades ago and who is now a loud proponent against this ideology. They have all done it through scripture. So basically, they went into this ideology and through scripture, believing that this was the true Islam, and they pulled themselves out through it as well. And they did that by basically speaking to religious scholars, by reading the text very carefully, by understanding that even though one portion of Islamic scripture might say to behead the infidel, another part of the scripture contradicts that and is a proponent of peace. And so they came away with an understanding of the richness of the religion, and an understanding that it is a layered faith that does not support one path. And I find these people interesting. I think that they can be a voice for others. They can be a guide for others. This particular person, Mubin Sheikh in Canada, I saw him actually pulling out a young woman that I was interviewing at the time. She was a young woman from Washington State, and she had fallen under the spell of Al-Qaeda. Her family was extremely worried. They thought she was going to try to travel to Syria. And I saw him online go back and forth with her, she trying to express, you know, the newfound faith that she thought she had discovered, and him basically saying, you know what, I was there, I know exactly what you're talking about, and let me tell you what I found out. So I wonder if there's more of a place for these people in our discourse. There are very few, and they remain very controversial. In the United Kingdom, for example, the Quilliam Foundation has actually, it's a think tank that is created for these people. They are there, they're given salaries, and they write research papers and lecture on this topic. But it remains quite controversial because you're giving a voice to people who at one point advocated violence, if not carried it out.
You mentioned the story about a woman recruit, but I am interested, and you've also covered this, about what it is like, and I think we know to some degree what it is like for a woman to live under ISIS. You talked to a number of women at a refugee camp. They had been in Mosul. The dress code was so strict that even their eyes had to be covered.
Yep.
What is that about? I mean, it's to make women invisible. Is ISIS afraid of women?
I think ISIS, I'm not sure if they're afraid of women or if they just quite bluntly, don't feel that there's any place for women in society aside from being the sexual partners of men and mothers and daughters. When I was interviewing this young woman in Washington State, I, of course, you know, I'm a feminist. I'm a proud working woman. I cannot imagine living in this kind of society. And I went at the interview from that perspective, and I realized very quickly in speaking to this young woman, Alex, that she had struggled to find a job. You know, she was in her early 20s. She was still living with her grandmother. She basically wasn't able to make her way on her own in her life. She had had difficult relationships with men, even abusive relationships with men. The idea of being covered up and not being seen as a sexual entity was actually comforting to her. And so I suddenly realized there's a very small percentage of the population that might actually find some of these things comforting, you know, that you are basically covered up and locked away and presumably taken care of.
I understand that certainly to some degree and certainly under certain circumstances. But as you describe, women were really, some of them were giving the lash for even just the tiniest piece of skin that was exposed. And on the other hand, we read about and you write about women and girls who've been turned into sex slaves. So it's this really disturbing contradiction that, frankly, I don't quite understand.
Well, I mean, Not in any way to try to justify what they were doing, but the sex slaves are women that are being taken from the Yazidi community. Okay, so they are not Sunni Muslim women. So the Sunni Muslim women who travel from the West to join this group believe that they are going to be the mothers of the caliphate, the wives of fighters. They of course discover a very different reality when they get on the ground, starting with the fact that whoever they're married to, if they are a fighter, is most likely going to be killed very quickly. And as soon as they are without a husband and without a male basically chaperone in the society, they are useless, and they are marooned inside a home for women until they marry again. And so they basically are pimped out. You know, they marry and marry and marry until they themselves are killed in an airstrike. This is the kind of message that I think is important to get to these women to elucidate. And it was this type of information that I think swayed Alex, that finally made her realize that what she was hearing from them was not necessarily the truth.
We're almost out of time here. The response in England, of course, they've raised the terror threat moment of silence. There's been a lot of memorials, people speaking about the victims and speaking about their community. Is that helpful?
Right. Well, I think the raising of the terror threat is significant. It's been done very rarely in the United Kingdom, and I think it reflects real intelligence that something else is underway. The reporting that my colleagues in London have done suggests that they are looking for the factory where the bomb was put together. All of the information we have suggests that this explosive device that was used was sophisticated. It was able to, in one blow, kill over 20 people. And if you compare it just for a second to the bombs that were used in Paris during the Paris attacks in November of 2015, the three Stade de France bombers managed to only kill themselves and one other person.
I hate to do this to you. Hold on. We'll pick up on after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We've been talking about the terror attack at Manchester, England on Monday. Our guest, Rukmini Kalamachi, covers ISIS and Al-Qaeda for The New York Times. We're going to have to say goodbye to you in just a moment or two, but I just want to give you a chance, Rukmini, to finish your thought. I didn't like just cutting you off like that. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just pointing out that the force of the blast in Manchester on Monday was significant. It killed more than 20 people. And if you compare it to the suicide bombs that were used during the Paris attack in November of 2015, which we know were carried out with ISIS operatives that came directly from Syria, that had been trained by the mothership, at the Stade de France in Paris, they had three suicide bombers, and they altogether killed themselves and one other human being. Uh-huh. It gives you a sense of how well-placed and sadly sophisticated this particular device was that was used in Manchester.
Well, I appreciate your reporting, and I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Thanks so much, Rukmini.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. Well, President Trump told the Arab Islamic American Summit on Sunday that his administration would make sure the Saudis get a good deal from U.S. defense companies for their purchase of $110 billion in weapons and military hardware. He also said the U.S. wants to strengthen its relationship with the Saudis and other majority Muslim countries who were attending the summit.
Sovereign nation. And our first priority is always the safety and security of our citizens. We are not here to lecture. We are not here to tell other people how to live, what to do, who to be, or how to worship.
The president talked about the threat of terrorism, identifying Iran as the key supporter of terrorists and a major threat to the region.
Starving terrorists of their territory, of their funding, and the false allure of the craven ideology will be the basis for easily defeating them. But no discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three, safe harbor, financial backing, and the social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran.
Trump did not make any mention of Saudi Arabia's human rights record or its responsibility for the spread of an extreme ideology that has inspired terrorists like the ones who attacked the United States on September 11th. Well, in this hour of Radio Times, we want to talk about what was accomplished by this trip, and we asked Laura Rosen to join us, diplomatic correspondent for Al Monitor. And Laura, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Ali Al Ahmed, and he's director of the Institute of Gulf Affairs. He was born in Saudi Arabia, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Ali, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I do want to begin. There's so much to discuss in this time with the two of you, but I thought it was interesting that while candidate Trump said things like, I think Islam hates us, he called for a Muslim ban, he criticized President Obama, Hillary Clinton for not using the words radical Islamic terrorism, but President Trump did not use that word. Ali, is that significant, do you think?
I think it is typical of Mr. Trump, who do talk a big game before interacting with the other side. And I always believe that from knowing some of his background, that he was using this as mostly as election rhetoric. But in reality, he is looking, as he likes to put it, to make a deal. And I think that worked well for him in Saudi Arabia. He was received in the largest welcome ever given to an American president in Saudi Arabia with dozens of Muslim and Arab leaders. And he came back with a huge package, maybe around $400 billion. Mm-hmm. So I think that approach has worked for him. If you compare it to the Obama approach, the Saudis were very angry, and their media was assaulting Mr. Obama, even calling him derogatory terms.
Does that mean that President Trump has put trade before human rights when it comes to Saudi Arabia?
I think that has been generally the American policy since day one. You know, I think the lofty rhetorics that either Mr. Obama or other American presidents were stating, it did not materialize on the ground. They did talk some of the talk, but the walk, they didn't walk it. And you can see that reflected in the status of women in Saudi Arabia, the ongoing repression. In fact, during the Obama administration, the worst human rights record in Saudi Arabia occurred during those years of the Obama administration. So I think this is much more of a transactional a relationship, and no matter what human rights statements come from the United States, it hasn't materialized or been really a key part of the relationship.
Laura, I do want to get to you. One more question to you, Ali. So lecturing doesn't necessarily work if the issue is human rights? Ali?
Yes, I think the human rights conditions in Saudi Arabia is really a clear evidence that the United States has not done anything. And I can confirm the fact that the United States government did not spend a single dollar, for example, on promoting women rights in Saudi Arabia. And that gives you a good indicator of where is the real policy. You can say, oh, they have human rights reports and so on. But even these reports, which I evaluate every year, they really water down the issue very much. And the relationship has not benefited human rights. Vice versa, I believe.
Laura, it's so interesting, this speech that the president gave on Sunday, just a couple of days after there was an election in Iran, but he clearly, and I played a clip of that, he clearly was targeting Iran as the problem when it comes to terrorism and instability in the Middle East. How did that play in Iran?
I think that, Iranians that I follow, Iranian journalists who covered the nuclear talks, feel frustrated that they see Trump not recognizing that, in their opinion, the U.S. and Iran are on the same side of fighting Sunni-backed extremist groups like ISIS. And when, in the Trump administration has kind of internalized the Saudi Sunni worldview that ISIS is kind of an outgrowth of Sunni anxiety about Iran. And so I think Iranians, aren't sure that Trump understands that many of the 9/11 hijackers, for instance, were Saudis, and that they see a lot of the extremism, the violence, terrorism that Trump made countering such a big part of his foreign policy on the campaign, that they're not sure he understands that that's coming out of the allies he's cozying up to.
Does it signal a dramatic shift, do you think, Laura, in U.S. relations and even policy between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Really since 1979, but particularly since the Arab Spring, eruptions of strife in Syria and across the Middle East, Iran and Saudi Arabia have been kind of in a proxy conflict, backing different sides, particularly in Syria and Yemen. And so there's already been a whole lot of tension between them. And after several hundred Iranians were killed in the Hajj pilgrimage a couple years ago in a stampede situation, there was an attack by Iranians at the Saudi embassy in Iran, and they kind of broke off relations. There have been really quite a lot of tensions between the two countries already. This doesn't help. I think this doesn't help. Now, I will say, you saw the reception that Trump got, very warm reception he got in Saudi Arabia. And then in Israel, these traditional U.S. allies who were feeling a little bit nervous as Obama pursued the nuclear deal with Iran and kind of helped legitimate Iran's return to the world after that nuclear deal was struck. Not saying that the U.S. approved of everything Iran does in the region, but treating it like a country that has defense concerns. The part of its posture is explained by Iran's concerns about its defenses in the region. I think that these allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia in particular, were very happy to see Trump take a more traditional path and kind of reject Iran, ignore the elections, and badmouth Iran.
Ali, the Iranian foreign minister tweeted after Trump gave his speech, "Iran, fresh from real elections, attacked by POTUS in that bastion of democracy in moderation." Obviously, a lot of snark and sarcasm there. But is there some truth to that?
There is truth to that. I remember when Condoleezza Rice spoke in Cairo, she repeated, this is like a history repeating itself, she criticized and condemned the Iranian presidential elections, and the paragraph next to it, she praised the Saudi municipal elections for powerless council where women were not allowed to vote or participate. So really, this goes to the credibility of the American policy in the Middle East. It's true, you can criticize American elections or Iranian elections for shortcomings,
sure,
but you cannot at the same time, in the same breath, do it from Saudi Arabia, where 2 days before Mr. Tillerson spoke, the Saudi police arrested a woman for being a witch. I mean, that doesn't really sound good, and I think people in the region are really smart enough to say, well, wait a minute, you know, Iran has problems yet, but you cannot say it from Riyadh and where, you know, the conditions exist where no elections or no women's rights. And I think that is the reason why Mr. Tillerson chose not to have American reporters in his press conference, to avoid these questions.
Is there a way, I'll put this to both of you, but first to you, Ali, is there a way to compare Saudi Arabia and Iran and the support for terrorism? Is one more responsible for the other than the other? Or do they both play the sort of unique roles in this, the spread of terrorism? Ali?
Yes, I think as a good test, I always say to American officials, find, put the list of names of terrorists who killed your people, who killed, who you talk about all the time, and figure out what kind of religious ideology they follow. You will see in September 11, the bombings in Manchester and London and Paris, all of these shared the same exact religious ideology that the Saudi monarchy or the government there is pushing. And there is a relationship between Saudi religious funding and so on and terrorism. You see it in Nigeria, in Indonesia even. And so the problem, the majority of the problem, this is not saying that Iran is not supporting some other groups, but the majority of the, you know, when was the last time you heard about an Iranian suicide bomber, for example, in Europe or in the United States? It doesn't happen, but it doesn't mean that countries do not practice terrorism. They do. It's important to realize a fact that a lot of people unfortunately ignore, the fact that these organizations, the non-state actors, are not acting on their own. These are not part of a grassroots movement. These are state-sponsored organizations. Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait support, in various degree, the governments of these countries support ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other related groups. That's why you see them continuing living and expanding. They cannot do it without government money.
Laura, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Well, you know, the U.S. publishes state sponsors of terrorism reports, and sorry to contradict Ali on this, but the U.S. does say that Iran is a state sponsor, it's the biggest state sponsor of terrorism groups like Hezbollah, and it does not say that Saudi Arabia as a state directly gives money to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. You know, Al-Qaeda has attacked Saudi Arabia and was founded by against the Saudi government's alliance with the United States. And is Saudi Arabia is fighting ISIS as well in this coalition. Now, I know that there are people in the Gulf states and the Sunni Gulf states who send money and weapons and stuff to those groups. And the U.S. and these countries have been trying to counter that. And I think what Ali's, I do agree with is he's saying there's an ideology, there's, you know, maybe support for preachers or strains of very, very, very conservative, you know, Wahhabi Islam that could inspire radicalization, right? So, but that's, you know, I think that's part of what actually I think Trump is trying to do in reaching out to Saudi Arabia, getting the Sunni allies to try to deal with this problem, counter-radicalization, is he thinks they're the only ones who can fix this problem. This is not something that the U.S. is very good at doing. And so I think he is trying to lean into them to get them to fight this problem that largely does come out of their societies.
Do you think, Ali, they want to do that and they can do that?
I don't think so. I reaffirm the fact that these organizations, even popular organizations such as Hamas and Hezbollah, who have very popular support among their people, rely on state sponsor funding from Iran and Qatar. And within this realm of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, there are different you know, trajectories, people who are against the Saudis in favor of the Qataris. And we see that clearly in Syria, where Al-Qaeda and ISIS are fighting because their sponsors are on a different path. You know, there is no way these organizations can sustain themselves for such a long time. It takes a lot of money to move, to live, to without state sponsor. And, you know, again, this is the problem. The fact that we still have ISIS and Al-Qaeda 15 years, 16 years after September 11, because there are governments supporting this. These are not privately funded organizations. And I think that is maybe one of the main problems with the U.S. approach to this. These are state-sponsored, and in fact, in the room where Mr. Trump stood, there were several state leaders who supported Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS, and few miles away from where he stood, a global terrorist, arrested by the Treasury, lives. And because the State Department says this person or this country is the leading sponsor of terrorism, it doesn't mean it's reality, because everybody knows Qatar and Saudi Arabia support these things. And by the way, Saudi Arabia has not executed a single ISIS member of ISIS. They have executed protesters, but not a single member of ISIS.
About a minute before our break here, but Ali, is the support for these terrorist organizations, is it allowing them to do Saudi Arabia's dirty work?
Absolutely. These are proxies. And I think there is a statement by Saud al-Faisal that was reported in the Telegraph in 2014 that he said that ISIS is our reply, our response to your supporting of this Dawah party, which is the religious Shia party of al-Maliki and the current prime minister of Iraq. So this is not a new thing. We, in the people in the Middle East, we know, as we say in Arabic, that we are from the same village and we know how each other behave. And I can tell you that this is a state-sponsored, and unfortunately, because of political considerations and so on, terrorism has become a political issue rather than a security issue, where we need to tell the American people and people around the world and treat this issue directly. I think it's very easy to solve it if there is pressure on the Saudis and other state sponsor of Al-Qaeda and others.
I will pick up on that. That's Ali Al-Ahmed, and he's director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He was born in Saudi Arabia. Laura Rosen joining us as well. She's diplomatic correspondent for Al Monitor. We are talking about President Trump's trip to the Middle East, where he visited Saudi Arabia, gave a big speech in Riyadh, also went on to Israel. You can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. What was the message that you got from President Trump's trip to the Middle East? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. I'm talking with Laura Rosen and Ali Al-Ahmed. We've been talking about President Trump's visit to the Middle East, also how it was received by the leadership there and what it means for international counterterrorism efforts. Laura, let me go back to you and go back to the Iranian election of just about a week ago. The moderate president got reelected, Rouhani. What was the message that the Iranian people were sending to their leadership?
Yeah, it was so interesting. You know, Hassan Rouhani's been president the last 4 years when they negotiated the Iran nuclear deal. I got to cover most of those negotiations, which were really fascinating. And the people are giving him another chance for 4 more years. You know, the conservative complaint, his rival's complaint was, you know, you got this nuclear deal. We accept that is the law of the land now, which was also interesting. But they said, but the people in Iran are not really feeling the economic benefits that you promised. So I think that is true. But people thought that Rouhani's message of continuing to try to engage with the world and taking a more centrist path was likely to lead to better lives for themselves than going back to a more antagonistic approach.
Does the president have that kind of authority?
Iran has somewhat limited authority. They have a control over the administration. He had the nuclear file from the Supreme Leader to negotiate that. There are the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps are the external military supporting proxy groups in the region that are so antagonizing the Sunni world as well as Israel that Rouhani has not been able to rein in. One interesting thing about this election compared to earlier ones is that Iran's Supreme Leader Khamenei is pretty old. I think he's in his late 70s and is reported to have had some health issues. And so I think some people have an eye that this election is not only about who would be Iran's president, but who might be Iran's next Supreme Leader and which direction they might go. And the candidate who lost to Rouhani this time, Raisi, had been seen as a potential Supreme Leader candidate. I think the size of his loss means that that would not have so much legitimacy, and it's possible that Rouhani may be a candidate for Supreme Leader. So some of the lines that he's pushing against, and he was really quite forward-leaning at the end of his campaign about talking about negotiating with the West to lift the non-nuclear sanctions as well, which would require quite a change in Iranian behavior. That really goes against Khamenei's red lines. But, you know, I think some of that is signaling what he might do if he was Supreme Leader or the country went in that direction in the future.
Oh, that's so interesting. Ali, how does Saudi Arabia view Iran? Do they see Iran as their enemy?
Yes, this is nothing new. Yeah. Going back Saudi history, this is not the first time Saudi Arabia has tried to combat regional powers. They did it with Egypt during the Nasser time, and they even did it with the Morsi administration. They did the same thing with Iraq, yes, in Egypt. They did the same thing with Iraq under Saddam for a while, and they are doing it as we speak. And the same thing with Syria. So this isn't nothing new for Saudi Arabia. They have been trying to manage their large neighbors, and they have been able, successfully, I might say, to use the United States might, political and military might, to do that. I think Mr. Trump's statement is right, that the fact that Saudis have been taking advantage of the United States and U.S. wars in the Middle East largely served Saudi Arabia and its position in the region, and they have been able to do that. Very smart, really, policy to have somebody fight for you, almost a proxy for Saudi proxy.
You're talking about the Iraq War, Libya,
All of that. Libya was more Qatar, but in terms of Egypt, for example, in terms of Iraq, the invasions and getting Saddam to fight a war, to wage a war against Iran, for example, that was one of their way to manage Iran. The same thing with supporting rebels in Syria, and very similar now in Yemen. They are waging a war with U.S. and British help. So this is really part of what the Saudi policy has been. They are extremely insecure about their neighbors, and they make sure to weaken their neighbors. Iran poses a great threat. One of the most important things we need to realize in the West, that Iran is really the most, historically, the most influential Islamic power, because Sunni Islam was shaped in Iran by Persian scholars. If today the majority of the Sunni Muslim historical scholars are Persians, then Iran became Shia 7 centuries ago, and it played a major role in Shia Islam. So in terms of historical impact, Iran plays major role. In fact, despite the fact that Saudi Arabia is the birthplace of Islam, in terms of ideology and writing and philosophy, were born to Persian scholars. So the Saudis are scared of that. They don't want a rival in terms of ideology. They see themselves as the leaders of the Muslim world and Arab world. And they can do it right now because they have the oil and they have the control of the most important religious places in Islam, Mecca and Medina. And I think the Iranians are at a disadvantage because of that.
Well, I'd be curious, Laura, what you say. I mean, that's so interesting. And we're talking about rivalries that go back centuries here. Do you think that's what's driving policy in Iran?
You know, Iran is a big country, and it bigger than Saudi Arabia. It doesn't have alliances like Saudi Arabia does. As Ali was mentioning, it has the U.S. alliance, and Saudi Arabia has the Gulf Cooperation Council, sort of the big player in Sunni Gulf countries. Iran doesn't really have allies except for Assad in Syria and Hezbollah, and that's partly why it supports these groups like Hezbollah,
Yes, and they've but Iran's not as preoccupied, I would say, with Saudi Arabia as Saudi Arabia seems preoccupied with Iran's support for proxy groups they see destabilizing countries in the Middle East. You know, Iranians are worried about their own economy mostly. It seems like they want to have kind of more normalcy. That seems to be what people were saying in the elections. They want to be a more kind of normal country.
Well, and Iran is a very, it's true for a lot of countries, but Iran is a very young population, Laura. I assume most of them born after the revolution.
Yes, I'm sorry I don't have the statistic on me, but it is, you know, and there are, you know, things you have to worry about if you're in Rouhani's administration is, you know, there's very high youth unemployment, something like 20%. Yeah. You know, people want jobs, and they have a very educated population, but you need to make sure those people have quality of life and jobs, not so different from what leaders in, you know, all over the world are worried about satisfaction of economic,
sure.
You know, yeah.
Ali, whatever happened to the Arab Spring?
I think Arab Spring, one of the people, the anti-Arab Spring powers succeeded. We see that in the overthrow of Mr. Morsi and the intervention in Libya between two sides in the Gulf, one on side of the Qataris and the other the UAE. And I think The reason that these monarchies, especially in the Gulf, the wealthiest Arabs, have been against people power, because if you look at historically in the Arab region, Egypt was a monarchy, Iraq was a monarchy, and Iran was a monarchy, and Libya was a monarchy. So these monarchies started falling, every few years, and they were worried about that. So they made sure that it doesn't happen to them. So they are very sensitive to any model that brings in people's power. Mohamed Morsi, the deposed leader of Egypt, was the son of a farmer. That dream of being a leader of your country, although you were born to a farmer father, is in the hearts of many people in Saudi Arabia. And I think that's why these monarchies stood in the way, and they were successful. I think they also got some support from some certain Western quarters that who view independence of these countries to be a threat to the Western influence in the region. And I think what distinguishes the Iranians from the Saudis that they feed themselves as independent. They say, Istiqlal Azadi, we want to be independent. This is not related to the Iranian revolution or this regime. It's always been the case. World War II was an example of that, where Iran saw itself as this ancient empire that just want to be independent from the East or the West. And Saudi Arabia has no problem being part of the Western axis. The Iranians don't want to be part of any axis.
Let me read an email from Joe. He said, I heard Trump's Riyadh speech on NPR Sunday morning. I took it as a declaration of war on Iran and Hezbollah. Laura, do you think that's how people in Iran or some people in Iran heard or viewed that speech?
I think there were some people who were upset by his speech, but that they also have the thought that maybe he's talking tough, but that his actions haven't necessarily followed his tough talk. And I noticed that in Israel as well. There was a lot of kind of backslapping and praise from Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, for Trump talking tough on Iran without enunciating really a change in policy. And I don't know if we mentioned that last week, before Trump left on his trip, the U.S. actually waived sanctions on Iran for its compliance with the nuclear deal, even as Trump, you know, said it was the worst deal ever, and he doesn't understand why Obama gave the Iranians, he thinks, such a great deal. So the U.S. so far is complying with the nuclear deal. So I think that they're watching not just Trump's words, but they're watching his actions as well. And that, you know, it's still to be determined how tough he plans to get with them.
Let me hear from Sheldon, who called our comment line.
My name is Sheldon. I'm calling from Philadelphia. The message that I got from President's trip overseas was just very contradicting. I was very confused. We're making this huge deal, arms deal, security deal, whatever you want to call it, with Saudi Arabia. you know, when they're in fact supporting ISIS and terrorist, you know, organizations. I just would have liked to hear more peace talks instead of weapons deals.
Instead of weapons deals, something we've been talking about, Ali, and it's true, the weapons deal, the military hardware deal, was a centerpiece of Trump's message to Saudi Arabia. Does that then become sort of the number one issue and everything falls to the background, or is that just what the U.S. has done? Because certainly Obama had a weapons deal with Saudi Arabia as well. Yeah.
Yes, I said that this is very much American policy. If you, you know, the most important parts of need in that country are not weapons, because Saudi Arabia is not going to fight a war against you know, a major country. They will do that against the Yemenis because they don't have much weapons to fight back. But if you look at the city where Mr. Trump spoke, 80% plus of that city does not have a sewage system. The Riyadh does not have a bus service. The schooling, most of the schools are rented homes instead of buildings constructed for schooling. So in terms of the economic needs in that country is maybe even greater in terms of unemployment among women, who is maybe around 80%, 70 to 80% of the people in Saudi Arabia cannot buy a home because the prices are beyond their reach because of the massive corruption and land grab by the ruling family. So these were much more important issues, the bread and butter issues for that country, more important. But they are not a priority for the monarchy, and they are not a priority for the American administration. And I think they could have made even a bigger deal on those issues than the weapons. And unfortunately, I think these weapons are not going to contribute to stability. Vice versa, it will make Saudi Arabia much more emboldened. Just a day after Mr. Trump left, they have an issue now with Qatar. It's open war, and the Qatari, one of their Gulf neighbors, and we will see the escalation. In the same time, where Mr. Trump was speaking in Riyadh, the Saudi forces are destroying a whole city a few hours away inside Saudi Arabia because it's a Shia city, and they're burning the houses and killing civilians in daylight. So really, the issue has been, I think, wrong. This is a U.S. policy. That's not a Trump policy. There should be other priorities, or I would say a balance of priorities when you address this, the relationship between Saudi Arabia. It shouldn't be between the U.S. and the monarchy. It should be between the country, country to country.
And Laura, we're almost out of time here, but in terms of at least the near future of U.S.-Iran relations, as you said, some of the sanctions have been lifted. What do you anticipate next?
So Secretary of State Tillerson in Riyadh, it was just after the Iranian elections, he got asked about that. And he said something interesting, that he didn't have any plans to call his Iran counterpart, but he expected that they would talk at the right time. So I would expect, as the Trump people get settled in, that we might see more engagement along with the pressure over Iran's other behavior that the U.S. doesn't like. And I think that would be a welcome thing, and that the reelected President Rouhani has expressed interest in that as well.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. Laura Rosen, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And she's diplomatic correspondent for Al Monitor. Ali Al-Ahmed, thank you very much as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And he's director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, and he joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download the newsletter, and check us out on Satellite Sirius Radio. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri are the Radio Times producers. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.